Complaints in the Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue.
Hello, Catherine.
I apologize for the delay. I'm at my daughter's and she's got an infant and we had a diaper emergency.
Oh, been there, done that.
I'm trying to help her out and my phone's ringing and ringing. I'm like, oh God, I can't. So anyway, thank you for your patience.
Being there, done that. All right, let me just start with this then. I'll go. Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Unfortunately, Tony's not with us today because he's still trying to get over his illnesses and stuff. So I'm here and I'm talking with Catherine Desmond, who played the channel in 1983 on April 9th. No, April 6th with the Modern Electrics. And opening for them was the Scatterbrains. Scatterbrains. Oh. So, but here she is. And you've done some wonderful stuff in Boston with everything over the years. But let's talk about the channel starting, and then we'll talk about the stuff we've done with the rehearsals and everything else, you know.
Sure. Yeah. I'm really surprised that you actually found a date. That's great. It's been a really long time, so I don't remember the dates, but I do recall I did play there about three or four times. Yeah. Over a 2 or 3 year period in the early 80s.
Yeah.
I remember once we opened for the Atlantics, that was kind of exciting because they were an up and coming.
Yeah.
I think they might have just been signed to a record label. So we were really excited about that. When I remember that Phil and Flash had done a really good study on all the bands that had played there and had them all up on the wall, and I wonder whatever happened to that photo. Because I would have loved to have had a copy of that.
That disappeared just like a lot of stuff.
Oh, too bad.
Yeah, we had some stuff we were able to save, but unfortunately some of that got in a fire at one of the guys' houses. It was in the garage, and the garage set fire, and we lost all that. We lost the Spinal Tap poster and everything, you know.
Oh, no.
Yeah, things like this happen once in a blue moon, and you just can't. You do your best to save everything, but you know it's over 30 plus, more than 30 years that we did this. I looked out. The reason you knew I got that date because I have a database that I built up from the Boston Phoenix over the years. And it's a database starting with every year, and it took 2 years to actually compile because I copied every one of the Phoenix ads that they had from Haiti onwards and stuff, you know, and I got piles of them. And it's good because you can reflect onto the actual times now because I remember playing, but I don't remember when.
I don't remember when. Absolutely don't remember when. I just remember approximately what years they were.
Yeah.
Okay. And I also played there before it closed.
Yeah, now you did the Bentmen, right?
And the Bentmen as well, right, yep.
And then you played separate with the band. Now, question about the music. You were playing keys, were you at that time?
In the Modern Electrics, I actually played all the instruments. We all were multi-instrumentalists, so we would rotate, depending on the song.
Excellent.
Depending on who wrote it. So, you know, whether it was bass, guitar, or keyboards, or synthesizers, you know, we all took turns.
That's excellent. Excellent.
Yeah.
It is Modern Electrics. No ifs, no buts.
Yep. I think I had, I'm pretty sure I was told when I bought it, like the first guitar synthesizer ever in Boston. I worked at a music store, worked at several music stores when I was younger. So and I was really into, you know, the latest gear.
Well, yeah, you could play them all. I mean, in Wurlitzer's, we used to go up there and torture everybody and look at new sound stuff that I could get, you know, and things like that, and play with
it. So I really wish I kept some of those things because they'd probably be worth a fortune now.
But they're worth a fortune in the brain because they're worth all your memories. It's amazing now what you can, once you get a click like this kind of thing that we're talking about. And what was the first experience when you did that? The first time with in the channel, was it an exciting situation, or was it people that you knew that had come just to see you guys, or was it a whole crowd of people?
Well, I think it took us a little while of playing around Boston before the channel, you know, to get a following, before the channel would book us.
Yeah,
you know, because I'm a venue owner now, so I understand the mindset.
Yeah.
Your band's great, and you got, you know, you're a cute little girl, but can you bring, you know, people in the door? And so I remember that was important to us, you know, to not book shows until we knew we could get a good crowd in there. So when I remember, I think we had a pretty decent crowd, and that helped get us other larger shows, like at the Paradise and things like that. But whether I played there or whether I went there to see bands, it was one of my favorite venues.
Wow.
I loved the sound system. And, you know, the stage, I loved that the stage was so big and high.
See, that's the thing. That's the key to that whole place, is the size.
You know, had a nice green room.
Yeah, it had everything going for it. It was a large
great
venue.
Great memories of the channel.
So what's your best one? What's your best one? You saw some acts that came through and enjoyed it.
Let's see. Misfits. And then getting to go backstage when Spinal Tap played. That was funny as hell. some girlfriends and I, we just got invited backstage, and they were
automatic.
You know, they all pretended they were still English, and they're like, "Oh, the birds are here." You know?
But you have fun, did you? Did you see the tile fell on from the roof on top of them with the water because it was pouring out at that night and what have you? Did you see that?
I don't recall them getting wet.
Well, I don't know whether they got wet, but I know the tile fell down at one point, and whether the water went the other way, it probably did. And, you know, when there was that false roof in there, it was just soaked all the time from the leaking on the main roof. And when I got there in 84, I took the whole thing down. I thought, let's get industrial. And what you were doing is promote performance art too, when you started doing with Dez and what have you. And I'm sure the same is performance art as musicians, when you're saying that each one of you in that particular band that you had played all different kinds of instruments. And so that was heartwarming. You go and play on one thing, and all of a sudden you play another song that's got totally different people. I love it, totally different, you know, people and a bit different vibe at that point, but it works. That's creative art more than anything. Performance art is what you guys did with the Bentman and stuff like that, and created good stuff.
I did the same thing. I did the same thing with the Bentman. I played guitars, I played keyboards, guitar synthesizers, I played bass, I sang, I sewed a lot of the costumes because I was one of the few people to know how to actually sew. So you know, it wasn't anything that we did for money. We did it just.
You loved it. You loved the whole thing.
The love of it.
And the creation, and that's continued on with your kids. I mean, they're doing the same situation, and they're creating, and they're following mom and dad in every aspect, and then they're taking it to the new limit, you know, which is a real plus these days, I think. I think it's just wonderful to be able to follow through from what the family started, you know, and still create in their own right, you know.
Well, I did manage to save, you know, a lot of my gear from my youth and put it in storage, and then when Casey started playing, she adopted my love of synthesizers, so a lot of the gear that I used to play, she plays now.
Excellent and, old stuff, it sounds great.
Mm-hmm, yep, some real vintage,
and adding that little voice and stuff into a big way, because you're having the vintage stuff with the big stuff with the voice. It never dies. It's never bad in any form. It's so good, you know. I mean, those particular things, the sounds that they used to make the old instruments, You know, I the reggae bands, for instance, they get all these old keyboards and they program and they just program one, and there may be seven keyboards up there just doing one song at a time because they're all pre-programmed. But it's the sounds that comes out of them that they've programmed in there. They don't want to change, even though it can be changed and just use one keyboard to do everything. They like the different flavor of the different. It's like the old Farfisa stuff and what have you. It's amazing what you can do with that stuff and make the feeling.
Well, nothing sounds like a real vintage Rhodes, you know?
Oh, no, no. No.
even if it's a synthesizer, even if it's a sample, it just doesn't have the same
twang.
Feel. You can't control it the same. It's all in your delivery, you know?
And it's
even
true.
With a really good weighted keyboard. From my experience, anyway.
I had Michael McDonald, who was Steely Dan, on just doing that, and it's phenomenal sounds he used to get out of that because it's so heartwarming, you know, and interesting in every aspect. And still to this day, that sound is one of my favorites from that.
Totally.
You know, it's
so smooth, so smooth
in every aspect of it, you know.
Any other questions?
I'm
really excited that you're bringing back, you know, memories of the channel because I had nothing but good memories there.
Tell them a few then. Just start doing a few with a few special nights, like you said. The Misfits for one was interesting. I saw them later on because they played a couple of times up there, more than once. You know,
I do remember I got kind of in a little bit of a disagreement. You're not supposed to do this, but in my defense, I was still very young, like 18, 19, 20, 21. and I remember getting into a disagreement with Rocky, the sound man. Oh, I don't know if he was still there when you were there.
This is before me, yeah.
Yeah, because I had so many pieces of equipment that I would mix them into a small mixer,
yeah,
and give that mix to the sound man,
yeah,
and he did not like that because he couldn't control everything. And I'm like, you don't have enough inputs on the board.
That's right.
for what I'm bringing here, I'm trying to help you, you know. So I think I frustrated him because he wanted. I think all sound men want you to sound good, but if you take the control away from them, and you know, a keyboard's too loud, or you can't hear a keyboard, or you can't hear a guitar, you know, because you're mixing it yourself. But that was a memory I had of, you know, him just, I'm like, I don't know what to tell you, guy. You're either going to have to take this mix or I cut half my gear in half.
I would never let you do that. I mean, I understand that philosophy because I used to plug everything up, including like Billy Cobham's 15 million mics on his drums, you know, that kind of stuff. But but the best one is when I built that monitor board for the channel. Actually, I built it for Mahavishnu Orchestra in 72. So that monitor board with all knobs on it and everything was, it had got 16 in and it had got 10 out. Plus, I could give you as on the stage a box with six channels that could be, you could mix your own on there, your own monitors in stereo or the headsets. Or in rebel cabinets, you know, on either side of you, especially keyboards, you could do all that. And rather than mix everything individually, unless I was doing Mahavishnu, I mix all Jan Hammer's keyboards all different, because it was that time to be able to do that until Jan got a mixer that he could put all his stuff through and feel happy that he was controlling it, you know, that kind of stuff. And it's a matter of the artist if they can control it that well, like you were telling me here, which I believe you can. All you need is that couple of left and right stems out of the English stereo. And the keyboards are really good from every point, your volumes and everything, you know. So I think that's a sad thing, but I understand that very much.
I think it was the only time I ever got in a fight with a sound man. You know,
What about Patrick?
Like I said, the only time.
Yeah, you had fun with Patrick Norton, and stuff. Because Patrick's wild, but he's good at what he does and stuff. You know,
I think they're all good at what they do. And,
I agree. It's just everybody has their thing. And, you know, like when I hear that you were playing all these instruments, I'm freaking out more about it. Now, I did not know all that today until you came on.
My whole life was between being a musician, you know, Des and I owned a recording studio. So I've done all kinds of MP&E stuff. And I have mixed bands and clubs, and I don't like it, because I don't like the, if the band's not great.
Well, I understand that.
No matter how good you are as an engineer, they're going to blame you. Yeah. They blame you.
always. That's why, you know, we were doing so many new music nights, but I was using the people that, like Scott Perlman and stuff, learning all this stuff. Tim Miller, Timmy Hines, and all this. But they moved on. Unfortunately, we've lost Timmy Hines, but Timmy Miller's a huge monster in the sound thing now. He's out with Will Smith and is partying with that lot, you know, and working, you know. And wow. And Scott Perman's in Nashville working with a whole bunch of Nashville people and whatever, giving it the old channel work, because, I mean, he's doing the production as well as doing the sound and doing everything for a country acts and stuff. And it's good, because they've learned through going through the rigmarole of working in the channel on new music nights and stuff like that. I mean, we do have some bands that came out of new music nights that were really good, and the ones that weren't got better in different bands, as the individuals got different bands, because you'd see them, you know, from 84 for me all the way through till the we closed the club in 92, you know. And anyway, let's get back to to you. What was the best one you watched, though, when you weren't playing there, that you saw? Because I know you and Des were going all the time. He told me that you guys would watch all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, local bands I would go see all the time. Because, you know, Des and I for 40 years have had some sort of rehearsal facility. So we've always gone to support the bands that, you know,
yeah,
supported
you,
us.
You guys
that
got
rented from us.
You guys got a big rehearsal hall for years after.
Yeah, yep, we still do. So, you know, we would always go and support, you know, our friends and our tenants and just local shows. And, you know, I saw The Residents there. That was great.
Yeah, I remember them.
And, you know, some of the other, let me see, who else did I see there? You're really making me stretch my brain here.
It's
been so long.
Well, you know, the clubs were in the town, you know, from the Paradise to all the other clubs in Cambridge and stuff would close around 1 o'clock. And we would be open till 2 o'clock. So we get the main artists wouldn't be going on until midnight or so. So people would be able to come from the other clubs after they'd seen the other acts or work them, and then come over there in the middle of the night to see this. And by the time 2:30, 3 o'clock come, you were trash, but at the same time you were, wow, did we just see so-and-so here? Did we just see this guy? Did we see Metallica in the back there? You know, that kind of stuff. And it's interesting to see the crowds that came over the years that I was there. I was impressed with the different kind of societies that came along because of all the different genres of music. I mean, you got the people like Billy Bragg people would come out. Then you got Gwar people that would come out, you know, and Bentmen that would be packed for two shows. I saw that was two houses full, you know. And,
yep.
And that's really sensational when you get packed houses in the channel, because there's, you know, 1,700 people in there plus, you know. And when Peter Limbo and Tony would tell you, well, we sometimes had a few more, but you know what it was like. It was a sweatbox. I mean,
that's what makes it so lovable. It's also what makes people drink. It's also what makes people drink.
well, yeah.
And as a venue owner, I understand the science.
Yeah, you got the magic shop now, and you understand. You make them sweat, and they'll all come to the bar and drink like fish and stuff.
Well, we are a little bit more little more laid back there because we don't have a liquor license. We're beer and wine.
Yeah.
So you can't really get totally wrecked there, even though I guess you can if you wanted to. But so the vibe there is just a little bit more laid back.
You should have an Irish night or two when they just have to sell you Guinness. We sold so much Guinness one night. We had to go to two pubs in Boston to collect bottles. I mean, no, big cans of Guinness, you know, the big ones, because we'd run out. I mean, absolutely run out. And it was just an Irish night with people like Bagatelle, who was the main Irish band before U2 came out of Ireland. And we didn't
get... that sounds like... a great idea, and I'm up for any idea that'll get people out. But you know, when I think of the channel, what I realize is that nowadays, and there's just not. We lived in this period when there was just so many good, not just local bands, but you know, regional bands,
exactly,
and touring bands,
exactly,
and you could go to the channel any night.
For a decent price.
Right, and see something good. And there just aren't that many clubs anymore that, you know, you can say, you having trouble making a choice what local band you're going to go see in a venue that big that just don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I know there's Roadrunner, but Roadrunner doesn't, you know, they focus on out-of-town major label or small label, you know, touring bands. They don't really do a lot of local. And so, you know, that whole paradigm is different now.
Yeah, the local scene went to New Hampshire, though. I think most of the bands that were up there, the metal bands and stuff, are still playing and stuff up north. And but there's not less venues. There's less venues everywhere for them to play. And if you don't bring in the people, those venues just turn into karaoke's and stuff like that. And
well, we have a lot of tribute bands at the Magic Room, and that is not by choice, but that's by what's available.
Yeah.
A lot of musicians now play in tribute and cover bands because they make money. When I was in Modern Electrics, when I played someplace like the Channel of the Paradise, I got paid.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and when I was in the Bentmen, you know, we got paid. Yeah. And we were a big band. We were sometimes 7 to 9, sometimes 10 people.
Yeah, no, it was big.
And bands nowadays can't ask for anywhere near that kind of money, local bands.
No, it's there's no people are not coming out like they used to do, any form. I mean, even just for the local bars these days and stuff. We live in Plymouth and. We see this quite regularly. There's a few nights, you know, there's a Saturday and maybe a Friday downtown where it gets crazy and everything and people are going from bar to bar. But it's very rare these days. I mean, the last few years it's dwindled down even more since COVID, actually. And people are not, you know, they're finding other alternative things to do and not go out. A lot of it is the social media stuff and... okay, we'll go to, and most people want to go to festivals or large events and then call it a day because it costs so much. I mean, when you go into the channel, when you go into the Paradise, $5, $10, maybe $20 maximum on coming in, but a lot of the time you were getting there for peanuts, you know, and you don't have to. That's the reason you could get all these people in coming in at night, and then they'd make big money on the bar, so they would be able to pay some of the bands. Like the Stompers and the Fools, because they ask for so much, you know? And they got that. And now they're asking for the same amount, and they really can't play more than one to two venues a month or something. Before, they could do 7 nights a week, all these guys, and all of you could do that.
Well, the economy doesn't just affects everything.
Totally.
You know, young people have to choose between... there is no disposable income anymore.
No, it just seems that way.
You have to whatever you make at your job has to go towards very crazy. Like Boston's the most expensive rent in the country.
Oh yeah,
in the country. Yeah. So you know, rent and then everything else, you know, all your living expenses. I used to be able to work a job or a couple jobs and have enough money to pay all my bills and still be able to go out on the weekend with my friends and have a good time and have a few drinks and go see a show. But I have children in their 30s now, and they're like, I'm like, hey, have you been to any shows? And they're like, well, I'd like to go to see this band or that band, but you know, Cyndi Lauper's $500 a ticket.
And, yeah, it's ridiculous.
And you know, and even like, you know, the Paradise is expensive for a ticket. And, you know, if you don't have an extra $200 to spare for, you know, drinks, parking, because parking's expensive. So I think it's different now than it was back then.
Oh, and it's like totally said, different. Going back, totally.
We were really lucky to be not just working musicians, but lovers of music back then, because we got to see whatever we wanted. And there was always at least three or four amazing bands in town to go see. And we would do that thing where we'd, you know, if it was a perfect night, you'd catch your friend opening at this time, and then you'd go over to this club and you'd catch your friend closing at that time.
No, it's true. I mean, that was the most enjoyable part about that time period. You know, you could go, I mean, some of our guys just went over to see the Pogues at the Rat or whatever it was, one of the places. They played, and then they came back to the channel and worked and said, yeah, this is fantastic. We can just go out and do this and come back. And this. Then all of a sudden the crowd comes in for the late night show, and everybody's enjoying themselves. And by 1-2 o'clock in the morning, you're like, okay, this has been a real good night. And it happened to be a lot of nights like that. A lot of nights like that, even with the crazy stuff going on outside with the bikers over the time, and that wasn't bad because they were supportive on everything, and they would come in droves to see people and play. Today, you see them on the street, and you just worry if they're going to come and run over you or something. You know, it's like it's a strange time. It's a strange time. The music.
Benny's back. You go ahead. Sorry.
No, the music was. It's changed so much that you've got to stick in that time period. My youngest daughter, she'll just turn on, as soon as she gets in the car, she'll turn on the 70s and sing every damn song that's on there, on the satellite radio, you know? And I'm like, okay. She says, well, that was a good time. It's really good and really good music and the good artists and this, that, and the other. Then she gets onto the 80s and she's only got a few really left. But yet, all the people that came through the club were spectacular. You know, whether it be a new music night band and there was only five people in the audience or whatever, it was still spectacular because they'd make it that way. They'd put the heart and soul into playing to show that we got music, we're good at what we do. And the ones that did continued on. I mean, you've seen everybody go quite well, and people would like to see the Bentmen again. I'm sure they would like to see you again. Doing this stuff, and but it's that age bracket that's going to come out. It's not the young bracket that would you would think of. You know, that's the thing. You know,
you can open up your laptop now and create such a soundscape with your computer.
Oh, totally, you know? Totally. But to me, that's not real.
We couldn't. It depends on the tools you use with your computer. I mean,
well, it
you know,
does.
There are some beautiful samples, and you can, you know. Well,
no, it's creative, but it's not. It's not you singing.
But it's not the same.
It's not the same. There's.
It's not the same. It's not community. There's no community.
Exactly. That's the word.
You lock yourself. In your room with your computer. You can create some amazing music.
Yes.
But the experience of collaborating with other people, of jamming, of, you know, just, you know, bouncing the energy off of each other, of teaching each other, of learning from each other, you know, I mean,
that's what I love.
That's important. But yeah. And there's, you know, there's still a lot of musicians. We, you know, we have the Sound Museum, so there's still people playing.
Good.
And there's still bands playing.
Good.
There's just a lot less of an opportunity for these people to play. There's no opportunity for them to make money.
No. It's just how many people are you going to bring?
And you know the good old funky clubs are going really quickly. You know, there's not many O'Brien's and things like that left anymore. Most clubs now are larger and they're owned by, you know, big conglomerates.
And just a cattle shed, basically. I mean, when you look at the Roadrunner you mentioned, it's a big old, it's worse than the town in respect of concrete everywhere. So the reflections for sound and everything is not anywhere like it should be.
The acoustic physics in there is weird, I know.
Yeah. So you go to the other one that's at Fenway down there that's pretty good because they've really tuned the place really well. But when you get in the concrete.
Are you talking about MGM?
Yeah. But it's a showcase. It's a showcase.
It sounds good, but last time I was there, I sat between two men over 6 feet tall, and their knees were bouncing up against the seat in front of them.
That's not good.
So, you know, no. So I'm sitting there with Dez and another guy to my right, and they couldn't even sit in their seats because they're too tall. So MGM seats are way too close to each other. So
that's not good. I didn't know that.
So it's kind of hard. I mean, I can't get Dez to go back there because of that, you know, because he's a big, tall guy. And I can't fit in here. And he's not gonna do general admission and stand up in the, you know, on the main floor for 3 hours.
No way. I mean, not these days.
Of course, we're old people now.
You're not old yet, but I mean, you get in there.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm grateful for the memories. I'm grateful for the good clubs that I got to play in and see bands in my, you know, my prime. But I do always want to be someone that supports new musicians. You know, that's why we still have the museum. That's why we still have a little venue, because we always want to be able to support this community.
I think... It's a wonderful thing that you are, but the main important ones are your family, is Casey, and that kind of stuff is to support them, and they'll support you because they'll come back with something that Casey's already doing now since she got that deal there and stuff.
Okay, Casey's still, you know, she's a new mom, so she's not doing a whole lot of music, but she's, you know, she was in the studio today, so she's still doing music. And, you know, and my other daughter, Mary, is an exceptional musician as well, and vocalist. So, you know, and keyboard player. She's like me. She plays like a bunch of instruments. All my kids play a lot of instruments because I didn't raise them to, like, think you can only play one.
No, just let them go at
it. Learn proficiency on whatever you like.
Exactly. And they've taken it on in tenfold. You know, I mean, because they're coming through with flying colors, and I think it's just it's wonderful, that kind of thing. I'm glad you're still doing some of this rehearsal stuff.
As long as they'll let us.
Yeah, I understand, you know, that. It's politics.
It's the price of real estate.
Yeah.
You know, here's the formula problem. Musicians can afford maximum $5 to $8 a square foot for a practice space.
Yeah.
And any commercial building in Boston is $40 or $50 a square foot to rent now.
It's ridiculous.
So even as a business that's trying to, you know, if we try to open another building, there's no buildings that are affordable anymore because we can't afford to pay the, like, really high prices because musicians can't.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
So I can build the world's largest rehearsal facility in Boston, and there's no way I can fill it because bands can't afford to pay, you know, $2,000 for a practice room.
No way.
You know, so we don't make a lot of money doing it, but it's necessary because, you know, we want musicians to be able to have a place to create and make.
You find out other musicians who are good, and you say, well, this one's improved tremendously by doing this. And
it's a community. They all, you know, I've had musicians knock on other doors and been like, I heard you playing bass and you're really good. Do you want to jam? And, you know, or I heard you sing, you're really good. Do you want to do, you know, some tracks on my recording? So, you know, the musicians have a community in there.
Exactly. Exactly.
They collaborate, say, "Hey, I'm playing a show. You want to open for me?"
You know, we used to do this in the '60s and collaborate with other musicians on the, you know, when we're doing the big circuit, this I'm talking with Fleetwood Mac and stuff. We'd go and we'd play with the Dead, and we'd go and play with different people. We had these young kids that came along in Austin, and we went to their house and jammed at their house. And they had never played out or anything. They became ZZ Top. And to this day, Mick Fleetwood and the lads of ZZ Top are still really, really close friends. And it's it's wonderful. You know, and that's what we used to do. That's the kind of thing in the middle of, middle of Austin, Texas, in the middle of the night at 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever it was after the show we did, and we just went over there, and next thing you know, they're like, wow, this is, Peter Green's going, whoa, I want to go and play more with these guys. Good. They've been practicing for 3 years. what they've had is everybody that passed through, you see, which you can't do today, because of the companies that own these people, jam with your friends that you meet on the road. You can't do the things that you're supposed to, that made you create other stuff. Like, you know, for instance, when we had Carlos Santana was in England at the Royal Albert Hall on a CBS thing. It was the first time ever he was in England and stuff with the Taj Mahal and then playing the Albert. We were over there with Fleetwood, and because we knew Taj, Carlos from San Francisco, and he said, would you come down to the studio? We're making an album called Then Play On. Do you want to come in there and hang out with us? He came down to the studio, and them guys jammed for 2.5 hours. I recorded everything on the big 2-inch. Well, actually, I had to go onto the safety reels on the 1/2-inch stuff because just let it jam. But that's where Carlos got Black Magic Woman from Peter there. He got the feel, he got the vibe, he got the whole thing, and he walked out there with such a big smile on his face.
I can hear that.
So
so cool.
It's just like wow. It's just like Mick that. Fleetwood and Mick and Peter and Danny went down. In fact, one day Danny and Peter went down to Abbey Road in the studios down there, and them guys are doing their stuff down there. And all of a sudden, Paul sees them come down the stairs and start singing "Here Comes the Sun King." And that became a song. And if you listen very closely to that whole album, it's very Fleetwood Mac oriented, old blues one, the whole thing. And that's why he came out. John Lennon came out with the Dirty Mac group. He had a Dirty Mac group after that. Everybody thought it was funny because they're playing the blues like Peter, but in a different way that they'd learned from other people, you know. And
well, they influenced so many people,
and that's. The Beatles were influenced so much by their friends, from Eric Clapton to all the musicians that were playing in town at that time would come over and jam and stuff. Today you can't get that in the studio. You can't get that anywhere. And Channel Days, we were having people come over and jam and stuff. That, you know, you get even the Metallicas that came in and stuff. They started liking other bands and stuff, the Mass and that kind of stuff, and they'd have a play together and what have you, because it's similar genre of music and what have you.
And well, back then there was only one place to practice at first, and it was the Cambridge Music Complex.
That's right. That was right. Yeah.
Jack Griffin. Yep. And I think it was a night that we didn't go back there after either playing or clubbing and jam until the sun went up.
Yeah.
With people we didn't even know. Yeah. We'd be like, what are you doing? Oh, we're going to go back to our space and jam. You know, and if someone was lucky enough to have like some beer in their car or live close by and have beer in their fridge, it would just be another party.
Yeah, like, you could do that. Jam. You could do that. It was wonderful.
You know, so the reason why the Sound Museum's open 24 hours is because that was some of the best times of our life.
Yeah.
Was getting to know musicians and jamming and no pressure, cutting loose, end of a hard work week. That was our fun, you know.
And definitely good fun. No ifs and buts. I love that stuff. I mean, we get trashed and stuff. On our way from a gig for Fleetwood and stuff, we'd go straight to the speakeasy in London. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning, we'd be in there. So other bands are coming in, from The Who to Jimi Hendrix. And the next thing you see is Jimi Hendrix playing bass, Peter Green on guitar, Buddy Miles actually playing drums. All these people were in there, they just got up and played and had a jam session there at 3 o'clock in the morning till six and stuff, having fun.
And that's the life of a musician.
Always fun. It was good. It was crazy because a typical thing, they'd turn around, Keith would start throwing strawberries at you and stuff, and then we'd throw corn on the cob back, and next thing it was a huge fuel fire. But the thing is that the good musicians would play, like I said, all different instruments and have fun with that. I mean, you wouldn't, Jimi Hendrix not only just played bass and guitar, he was in great accordion. He played all his stuff on the accordion first, because he'd go over on a regular weekday in to Charlie Watkins at Wem, and Charlie's does the accordion. In fact, every accordion that comes into England goes through his company.
That was my first instrument.
So I mean, you would sit there with Charlie and Jimmy and play for hours. Jimmy and him would play for hours, and he'd write songs on there too. You know, that kind of thing. That's how good these guys are into their instruments and having fun. And, I mean, you're there with Charlie, who's at that time an elderly man, and you were sat there going, this is outrageous. There's Jimi Hendrix over here. We're playing. I'm like, okay. and I'm having fun with Charlie and stuff, and then Jimmy's there playing away with them. In fact, there's some recording of them. But the whole thing is that it's just for fun. But at the same time, it's creating music and creating art and creating the mind and expanding the mind, because some of the stuff that Charlie was playing was from when he was on a boat in the late 40s, coming after the war or during the wartime, and coming from America and stuff, and he'd be playing the accordion. And he found a guy in Liverpool that was importing this, that, and the other with equipment, and next thing you know, Charlie decided he was going to start making this kind of equipment, and made the largest sound systems at that time period, the largest speaker cabinets, the best quality sounds at that time period for the first transistors in England. And we had fun with all that stuff, but, it's how you do it. It's how you've done it, and how you're still doing it and playing. I like that Casey's playing again today and singing along and stuff, and you were doing keys and stuff around having fun. And like you said, the museum's got to keep going. The whole thing with the rehearsal. In fact, one of our sound people, David Wenton, who worked for me for years, is over at... I just did the podcast with him when he talked about the channel and stuff, when I had him in there. And he did Everly's after that. He did Dr. John after that. But now he's teaching the kids at Berkeley how to do live shows and how to prepare for it, sound checks, the whole nine yards. And he's teaching them what we did at the channel. And he just had six metal bands in one day. So he says, oh, channel
start. God bless him.
Channel start. Boom, 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 boom. You put them up, line them off, take them off, and there's the next band. And that is so unfortunate. It's fun stuff if you do it creative. And that's what you've been doing, and Des has been doing all your lives here,
And hopefully continue to do it. I don't play a lot of music with other people, but I still play my instruments and whenever I get a chance,
Yeah, get it out and stuff. But you're busy all the time. You've got all kinds of wonderful stuff going on at the farm and everything.
COVID was actually the silver lining of COVID was, being kind of in the house a lot. And just getting to reacquaint myself with my grand piano.
Well, that's cool. That's cool, with the grand piano. And that's sensational. I'm sure you've got the grand piano. You can see out of the window into the farm.
You see the mountains, exactly.
Oh, you'd freak out with music from that. The music is so creative when you're doing that kind of stuff.
And it's just, it's like a bicycle.
Yeah.
You know, even if you haven't played for a while, if you just warm up a little and get back into it, yeah, it all comes back to you.
This is good. Well, we're going to start ending this little conversation, and I really appreciate it. I said to Des, we've got to talk to Catherine about all this stuff because she's been running around doing this for all her life and what have you. And,
Thank you, Dinky. This is so much fun.
And I think, it's fun because what I'm going to do is I'm going to post Des up in a week or two, and then you'll be up this following week because I did this with Donna Washburn and Brian Washburn from the club. And Brian was away doing tennis. So I said, let's do Donna. And she told me some fun stories that she did doing photographs in there. And then
where do you post this podcast? Where do I find it?
Well, bostonsbestliverock.com, they're all on there now. There's 24 of them, or 23 on there right now. Today, another one goes up. It's on iTunes, iHeart Radio. It's on Amazon Music. It's on YouTube. It's on Spotify, Apple, I think it was picked up. There's a bunch of... There's like eight of them.
You're with the major aggregators. I get it.
Well, you get them out, and then local scene where we're at now is in the podcast from Plymouth. Wonderful little studio that they've got here for the local community, and the people are great. And there's no ifs and buts and stuff, and they're doing a great thing with this little podcast room, and also the videos and the TV stuff that they've been doing. And I'm really happy to be here at this point after not being able to drive down to the Cape where we were doing it with Tony down in Dennis. And we're going to continue with talking to a lot of different people all the time on this podcast of Two Pints in a Corner, which I thought
I wish you the best of luck. This is really special that you're doing this. It just brought back a whole lot of memories, and
that's what we're after, is your memories to come back to come back and you say, "Well, why did I play that note that way that time? That particular song on that show was terrible." And then you go, "Oh, it was fantastic at the end." And stuff.
I don't have regrets for any music. I do have regrets for some of the hairstyles, the pink mohawks and the mullets and the.
Well, it's when it all changed. I mean, and the skinheads came and destroyed the place in some ways, because some of the music that the skinheads do is fantastic, but some of it in their personality it certainly changed into neo-Nazis and stuff like that, and I says, "Oh no, we're in a bad way right now." And that's when I couldn't believe it. I says, right at the end of the club and stuff, I'm glad it's closing because it's a sad thing in a lot of ways, but I'm glad it's closing because the potential of what was going off right now for trying to get people in at that time period was really dwaning towards the end anyway, because people were doing a lot more of the bigger shows, and it was costing more to do those shows too, you know. And so it was changing. Well, I want to thank you, Catherine, and thank you a lot in everything you're doing. And follow it all through. It's all music, whether you be growing plants or playing the keyboards or singing or whatever, playing the washboard, whatever it takes. Just have fun and keep doing it and keep emphasizing that to your kids. Let's do this, let's do that. Okay, I'm going to change the diaper right now, but there's a lot of nice song in there. I'll poop, poop, poop.
Thank you, Dickie. Be well. I'm going to go now. Bye-bye.
Okay, love you. Thank you, Catherine. And
yes.
Two Pints in a Corner, close it out.
You got it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.